Ladies and gentlemen, don't touch that dial, because Radio Disclosure is on the air. And today's guest is someone who is considered possibly from the dark side, someone who some folks are maybe a bit afraid of. This gentleman is credited for bringing Wicca from Europe to the United States. He's referred to as the father of Wicca. He's authored well over 50 books on the subject of metaphysics, and he is none other than Raymond Buckland. Is this gentleman from the dark side, or is he from the good side? Well, you'll have your opportunity to make that decision and find out for yourself firsthand as we welcome Raymond Buckland to Radio Disclosure. As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Transworld Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building, and they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. Transworldantennas.com. With us today is Raymond Buckland. And many of you folks are going to be real familiar with this fella, and some aren't. But I guess I want to say author. Yes, this man is an author. I've got a number of his books I've had over the years. And then, of course, I think that the scope of knowledge that this man has and has acquired over the years is so wide-sweeping and detailed that I don't really know what classification or category I could really put you in. But I'm going to say good day, and how are you, sir?
I am very well, thank you, Ted, and it's a pleasure to be on your show with you. I've written a number of books, but it's just because I just love writing. You just can't stop me.
Well, you know, I recall a book called Candle Burning Rituals.
Oh, yes.
I mean, and among others, but that was one that stuck out because it seemed like when I went through that book, I thought, where in the world did you come up with all this information? I mean, because this stuff is ancient. I mean, it goes back a long ways.
Right. Yes, that particular book actually came out in 1970 and is still going strong. It sold over 500,000 copies so far. But it was kind of a fun book. In fact, let me tell you the story of how that came to be written. I had written another book for Llewellyn Publications, who published the book. I did Witchcraft from the Inside, which incidentally is also still in print. But that came out in 1970, and they gave me a contract. And in the contract, there was a clause there, which is typical, which said that I would offer my next book to them before I offered it to anybody else. So I thought to myself, well, I don't really necessarily want to offer my next book to Llewellyn. I mean, I want to write all sorts of different things. I want to write fiction as well as nonfiction. So I guess I'd better write something just to take care of this clause in the contract. So I pulled together this book on candle-burning rituals, and I figured, well, that'll take care of that. And sure enough, it took care of it, and as I say, it's still going 45 years later, half a million copies, and it's still going. But it was just a collection of... I knew that a lot of people were interested in candles, lighting candles, when they did prayers, for instance, in the Catholic Church. Obviously, that's a very big thing, to go and light a candle and say a prayer. And I found that this was almost a universal thing. It wasn't restricted to the Catholic Church, even to Christianity. A lot of people tied in candles with prayers, or, if you like, with magic, and prayers can be no more than magic. And I found that there were different rituals that had come about in various places tied in with lighting candles and burning candles. And so I just collected all these together and put them into some sort of order, and that was the nucleus of the book.
You know, and there was another book, the candle burning book was kind of had a red cover to it, had a picture of a candle on the front of it. But there's another one that we had from you that was a green cover, and I can't remember what that was. I can't remember the title. I'm stretching, thinking, what was that thing?
Yeah. Well, the trouble is that the publishers keep changing colors. every so often they'll do another printing and give it a different cover. And I think the thinking behind it is that people will go into a bookstore and see this new cover and think it's a new book and buy it and then take it home and then find, damn, I've got this book already. But at least they've sold another book. So color of covers doesn't help a lot in general. Sometimes it does, but not a lot.
Well, you've got a new book out, and this book is on gypsy magic. And
that has a nice bright yellow color to it.
You know, and that's a fascinating subject. I mean, that's really something that I think everyone is... here's what's funny. You know, people are afraid of gypsies.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. They really are. They're afraid. There's something mysterious about gypsies, and you think, well,
right?
It's like
this whole sort of metaphysical, or if you like, occult field. People are afraid of what they don't know or what they don't understand, and this, I guess, is natural. And the more you investigate something, the more you find out about it. You find out what makes it tick, how it works. The less frightened you are, because you can see the inside workings, if you like. Well, it's the same sort of thing with gypsies. The gypsies seem to be a mysterious people. We don't know, or the majority of people don't know much about them, so they are afraid of them. And, of course, this has been fostered with childhood stories of gypsies stealing children and gypsies always being thieves and the like. Incidentally, there's an interesting reason why they got that idea thrust upon them as being thieves. The gypsies actually, they came out of the north of India back in about the 10th, 11th century. That's where they originated. And there was a time when there were a lot of invading armies going into that part of the country, that part of India, the Greeks, the Kushites, various people were invading that part every few years, it seemed. And so the local people started moving out. And they packed up their things and they just moved out, went west. They moved into Afghanistan, into Pakistan, into Persia, and kept moving on all the way until they got into Europe. And as they went along the way, their philosophy was that whatever is there, whatever is grown, whatever comes from the earth, comes from the gods. And so they would perhaps be going down a road and there'd be a large orchard of apples, and they would look at these apples and say, well, these are the gift of the gods. These, you know, come from the gods. So we can help ourselves. And they go into the orchard and they'd help themselves to apples, and they would take lots of them, so when they came to the next village they could sell them. Well, the poor farmer who owns that field would come running out and shout and rave that they were stealing his apples. But they had no concept of stealing, because they thought, well, how can anybody own a tree? How can anybody own something which comes from the gods? So they weren't stealing in the sense that we think of it. They were just taking what they felt was the bounty of the gods. Now, later on, of course, as years went by, they had a very hard time, and they had difficulty making a living, and they finally did resort to stealing, to thievery, because it was the only way they could survive. But originally, it wasn't that. Originally, it was just believing that everything came from the gods.
Well, now, I came across a gal from Ireland, and she said that her family came from a group of travelers, she said. And she talked about travelers, and that when I never heard the term before, so when I began to ask about who were travelers or what were travelers, of course, then she explained to me that they were gypsies, or they were at least either the same thing or similar. And it was interesting, because as I began to talk to her, I was talking to her about ghost stories and supernatural things, and she said to me, she says, "Oh, you should talk to my granny. She could tell you all kinds of stories." So what was the difference between, let's say, the Irish travelers and the gypsies? I mean, is it the same family of people?
Okay, there is quite a difference. Travelers is a generic term, if you like, that's been applied to any sort of nomadic group. And you get the hippies of the 60s, 70s who would, you know, take an old school bus and paint it up and go traveling, and they became labeled as travelers too. But obviously they weren't related to the gypsies, and neither are the Irish travelers. Main travelers are the tinkers. They're known as tinkers, and they are quite separate from the gypsies. The gypsies, as I've just said, came out of the north of India originally. So there is a generic line there. There is a line which goes back there, whereas the tinkers originated in Ireland. It's just a group of people who became nomadic, who didn't settle in any one particular place, but moved around. And they had wagons, much as the gypsies do. The gypsy wagons are very, very elaborate. But there is actually a great rivalry, if you like, antagonism between the Irish tinkers and the gypsies. And funnily enough, this was brought home to me a couple of years back when I was over in England, and there's a good friend of mine, Pete Ingram, who is a full-blooded gypsy who spends his time restoring gypsy wagons, gypsy vados, as they're known. And he said to me, "Oh," he said, "you should have been here last week." He said, "I had to close up the yard. I had to close the gate and lock it and keep everything tucked away because the tinkers came into town." So here he was, a gypsy, and he didn't trust the tinkers one inch. You know, they were all thieves and rogues, so far as he was concerned. And yet, so far as the non-gypsies are concerned, the gypsies are thieves and rogues. So I guess it's all a question of perspective.
Well, that's interesting, because the stories she told, I thought, were fascinating. You know, it kind of opened your mind to a different lifestyle, a whole different way of life. Of course, now they don't wander now today. They're obviously settled, and she's a professional.
Yeah, that came about from the Second World War, as a matter of fact. And the gypsies, I'm from an English tribe of gypsies, the tribes all over the place. But the gypsies appeared in England by 1513. There's the record of them in notes there. They entertained the court. They did this, that, and the other. Perhaps some of them were arrested, so there's record of that. So we know that the gypsies arrived in England by 1513. They were very active there, and they moved around. They would winter generally in the south of England, and then they would come the spring, they would move around and go to the various carnivals and horse fairs and what have you, move around. So by the end of the year, they would be back in the south again, ready to winter. Well, this was their life pattern until the Second World War. And just after the Second World War, the British government said that all children had to be in a school and had to be in any one school for at least a year. Now, up until then, as the gypsies traveled, some of them, not a lot of them, but some of them would send their children to a local school, whatever town or village they happened to be in. They would send the child there, and the child would get something of an education. And then as the family moved on, so the kid would go with the family, of course, on to the next town or village and go to school there. But with this law, they had to be in a school for at least a year. And this is what really curtailed the traveling of the gypsies. It meant that they had to settle in one place for at least a year. So this really, really put paid to the nomadic lifestyle, if you like, of the gypsies, certainly in England.
Well, one thing I wanted to bring up, and I'm gonna talk about this now. This may be new to you, or it may be something you don't want me to talk about. But nonetheless, I'm going to bring this up only because there is a number of people that are that the name Raymond Buckland brings fear to their heart. You know, you're a very mysterious person, and they equate you to, you know, the dark corners of things, you know. I mean, now there's probably a reason for this in a number of different areas, but the first I had ever heard of you, I was attending a church, and I was rather young, and as there was a fellow there by the name of, who was a guest speaker, his name was John Todd. Have you ever heard of this guy?
Oh, yes.
Okay, well, anyways, the presentation that was given was that he was involved somehow in some sort of a family that was connected to the Illuminati, and that the Illuminati controlled the entire world, and everything revolved around this character, Philip Rothschild, and they had taken him into some city somewhere, wherever he was, you know, and he was supposed to learn the ropes, I guess, and when he got to the city, wherever this was at, he was introduced to you, and you were the one to teach him all of the darkness that he needed to learn in order to do all these things, you know. Well, later on, inside of the Christian church, the Christian circles, they pretty well near flogged this guy and sent him to the streets eventually, because as he began to talk, his tails got wider and longer and taller, and he made a round in the Pentecostal circles and the Baptist circles, and I think his final fling was in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they finally threw him out of there. So, but anyways, there was a lot of people that till this day all they remember is what he said, you know, from the pulpit, and what he said on cassette tapes and CDs or wherever it floated around. And I'm just going to say, you know, and here we are told that the people inside the church are the good guys, you know. So anyways,
yeah.
But I wanted to bring this up because I think there's a lot of false fear, a lot of false impression as to who you are, what you do, and you have no connection with people like, I guess I want to say, Anton LaVey, who
right.
I found this fellow real I guess I want to say I found him entertaining, you know. I really did.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, I certainly knew of him. He, in the what I call the early days of the craft, certainly in this country, witchcraft in this country, I was the one who brought Wicca to this country from England and introduced it. So I became public, forced into it, actually. I originally set out to merely straighten the misconceptions about witchcraft, and witches do not worship the devil. They don't even believe in the devil. They don't do black magic. They're very, very positive, very nature-based religion, and do good. And I tried to straighten that. I did a lot of lecturing, a lot of talking. Of course, wrote the book Witchcraft from the Inside. And I did several interviews for newspapers and magazines, but I always asked them not to use my name, my full name, or give my address, because I wasn't looking for publicity for myself. I was just looking to straighten the misconceptions about witchcraft. Well, all went well until I was interviewed by a lady from, a lady, I use the term very loosely, a reporter from the New York Sunday News. Her name is Hoffman, Lisa Hoffman. And she came to interview me, and she seemed very, very very interested and wanted to know everything, and she told me very definitely she would not use my name or anything, any personal details in the article. And of course the article came out, and there it said Raymond Buckland, who lives on Timberline Drive in Brentwood, Long Island, New York. And so the cat was out of the bag then, and I had all sorts of problems. Well, we had all sorts of things happen. I mean, I had my car set on the fire, I had rocks thrown through the window, my kids were certainly verbally abused. We had a lot of problems. Anyway, it did mean, however, that since my name was out there, it meant that I could then go out and do a lot more in trying to straighten the misconceptions. It meant I could do television interviews, for example, and things like that. I did feel that it was part of my job, if you like, to do that straightening of misconception. So I did a lot there. So I became very public in that way. Well, this was about the time that Mr. Todd was running around, and he, seeing how much my name was to the fore, connected with things like witchcraft and magic, that's what set him off, and he made a very decent living for quite a while going around to these different churches and being treated, taken care of, and wined and dined and what have you, and giving all this nonsense. Now, I never, ever actually met the man, so I don't know where some of his stories come from. But the Illuminati, of course, has been around since the 16th century, or been talked of since then. They originated in Portugal, actually, as a matter of fact. They were supposed to be trying to establish a new world order, but in order to do so, they were trying to destroy the old world order. Well, I knew, certainly in those early days, I knew virtually nothing about the Illuminati other than having heard the name. So I couldn't have taught anybody what they were teaching. I couldn't have taught anybody anything about them. I always stressed throughout my teachings of the craft and throughout all of my books, and you can check any one of my books, I've always stressed the positive on the side of good, if you like, as opposed to the side of evil. Always doing good. I've always stressed that if you do harm, that harm will come back on you. So obviously there's no inducement to do harm. You should always try to do good. So I've always tried to live by the golden rule, always preached that, always taught it in my lectures and workshops. But this guy Todd, and there were a couple of others also actually running around, found that, as I say, that they could get a good living by claiming to have been into witchcraft and taught by the great Ray Buckland, as they put it, at that time. And this gave a certain notoriety to them. As I say, I had never actually met the man. I did hear a recorded cassette tape of one of his lectures or sermons at one time, speaking at a church. And it was kind of amusing because he would throw out quotes from the Bible, and obviously he didn't really know the Bible. I mean, I don't know the Bible either, for that matter, not to any great extent. But in his talk, he was ranting on about the evils of rock and roll, and he said, "You'll find that this is spoken about, is damned in the Bible. If you turn to Job 14:21, you'll find the thing there, and all the old elders of the church were nodding their heads and agreeing." Well, I stopped the tape and I went and checked Job 14:21 or whatever it was that he said. And there was absolutely nothing there about music or rock and roll or anything. It was a totally different subject. But by throwing out supposed references to the Bible like this, people thought that he was very learned and that he was a good Christian and this, that, and the other. So this is how Mr. Todd went along, but I guess people gradually realized just how phony he was.
Well, you know, the only reason I bring this up, and that is this, you know, I was raised a very, very conservative Christian here. Uh-huh. in the United States. And I guess the one thing that I've observed, and I think one of the reasons why the churches today in our country have a rough time, and that is I think people have just got on to the fact that you can only manipulate the public so much, you can only build in so much fear,
right?
You can only misrepresent things so far, and then people get disillusioned and they get discouraged and they become uninterested. The fear part of it, though, and the misinformation part of it, is all part of it. And I guess, you know yourself, you're a student of history. This goes back thousands of years. I mean, this is something that's gone on since, one of the reasons why the Apocrypha is not in our King James Bible was because somebody was manipulating back in those days, so.
Right, absolutely.
But the thing of it is you bring to the table knowledge and information, that you've collected over years. And I mean, a lot of these things are traditions that you've studied, and you know the history behind them. So your books are fairly accurate, but they're exactly like you're saying. This is not, the candle burning ritual book was not a book on how to, make your neighbor break out in hives and itch for 4 days. I mean, this has nothing to do with that, or how to get rid of somebody you don't like, that type of thing. It just wasn't, written in that manner. It was written as to how to, I mean, there's all kinds of things in there about how to bless and enhance and make life better, And of course, how these things work is another subject altogether. But, psychologists today have come to the point where they've actually said, the passage in the Bible that says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. There's a lot of power behind that. There's a lot of power in thought and positive thought and focus and concentration. And I think a lot of this stuff, like in candle burning rituals, I mean, this really does bring a person right straight into a focus, and it allows the energies within inside the human being to become aligned in such a way that, whatever it is probably going to happen. And I, basically all my life, it's a weird thing. Anything that I wanted really bad, and that I focused and concentrated on, eventually wound up in the middle of my life somehow, and I really wouldn't know how to explain that other than it happened, So I wanted to dispel this immediately, because I know we have a pretty traditional crowd that listen to this radio show. And the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to dispel this, because I don't want what is the word I want to use where you play off of somebody else's career? You kind of leech onto them and you build. Anyways, I don't want that going on. I want folks to be able to get acquainted with you and know you for who you are and what you do. And
I always stand by what I say and what I write, what I teach. And I've heard these stories of people having the wrong impression of me. And it doesn't worry me, because I know that eventually truth will out, if you like. By my writings, by my published works, by my lectures and workshops, by people who have actually met me and spoken with me, I know that eventually the truth will come out. What I had been going to say a little while ago, when I lost my train of thought, was a lot of the fear, a lot of the restriction of the church, a lot of the power of the church has been lost, because today people are so much more educated. People are educated to the point where they don't necessarily accept everything that's handed to them without questioning it. They do question now. Kids are brought up to ask questions, to research, to look into things. And this is where the church has lost a lot of its power, because they used to be able to say, such and such is so, and you will believe it, and people will believe it because they had no other way to turn. But these days, now they've got the education, they can turn. They can turn to the internet, for example. But they can research, they can read, they can look around, they can observe. They can really learn things a lot. And this has taken away a lot of the fear of the church, of the priesthood.
Well, I'm gonna jump tracks here just a little bit, because you have another book, which is A Field Guide to Ghosts.
Right.
And I've been looking through. This is another one of these books where you've just about not documented everything. You've given everything a label and a name, you know, and things I've never even heard of before. But the thing that fascinates me now is every time you turn on a television set, almost. I mean, it seems strange, and maybe just me. There's one of these ghost hunting shows on television,
right?
And they're taking out the scientific instruments, you know. And I'm going to say some of the stuff's not all that sophisticated, but the one little device I've been really impressed with is this little thing called the K2 meter, which is basically a meter that measures milligauss. And you can make it light up if you hold it near a magnet, or if your cell phone gets near it, it'll go off. So it's measuring energy that's in the air. But it goes over quite a large spectrum. We've actually tested it to see where it was most sensitive, because we're a bunch of engineers and ham radio operators and whatnot. So, you know, some of this is met with skepticism. But we went into a location where there was absolutely no power whatsoever. The power had been shut off. And everyone's cell phones were turned off. There was nothing in there RF-wise that could, radio frequency-wise, activate this thing. And I had carried with me a digital field strength meter with a counter on it, which is a thing made by our good friends down in Mississippi, Martin Jew at the MFJ Enterprises. I had this thing in my hand, and I'm watching, and they start talking, and this thing starts flashing. And I was like, what in the world is setting this off, you know? And I guess that's the wrong question, because it probably isn't anything in this world that's setting it off.
But I
was watching this thing flash, and I had some skeptics with me that could write the book on skepticism. And their jaws were hanging down, and we're all watching this, you know. And I'm holding this field strength meter up, and I'm actually seeing something on the field strength meter as well, which seemed to be coming in somewhere between right around 500, 600 megahertz, but it was almost like watching a spread spectrum signal. It was just all over the place. And there was nothing in there. This place is isolated. It's several miles off the road with a power shut off. There was no power lines. There's no radio transmitters. There's nothing in there. And, you know, those meters can't light up on their own. Well, I've watched these shows, and I see the ever-increasing popularity of this subject. People are curious. They're wanting to see something. They want to experience something. They really want to. I mean, I think after years of being disillusioned by a lot of religious organizations, they really do want to hear something go bump in the night, you know.
Right.
I want to believe in something is what I think what most people are saying. So, and of course, now there's the popularity of all of the groups that are local, for example, the Meetup organization. We've got several here. One in the Nashville area, which is there's a paranormal investigator. Well, it's two or three paranormal investigator groups here in Nashville, and each one of them have 200 to 300 members. And it's all over the country. And if you go up into the Meetup thing, you type in and Meetup, type in ghosts or paranormal, type in Wicca. These groups are everywhere. And so there's something drawing these folks into these areas, you know, so they're curious. And what's interesting is that a good majority of them, of course, now this friend of mine said to me, he says, well, now if you go to one of these meetings, he said, you know, you're going to run into people that are into sacrificing babies and all this. I said, really? You know, well, I went to the first two or three meetings and whatnot, and these are disenfranchised church people. I mean, these are people that went to church all their life. They said, enough of this, you know. Mm. The meanest people I find are located inside of the local Baptist church, okay? So we don't want to go there anymore. They're kind of on a quest, you know. They're looking for something.
Right.
And I found this book, the one that's the... Now, is that Wiser, or is that, how do you say that word, Wiser?
Yeah, it's Wiser. Yeah.
Wiser Field Guide to Ghosts, Apparitions, Spirits, Spectral Lights, Other Hauntings, History, and Legend. Why does that sound so interesting? Why is that? That's like, wow, I want to
It's the unknown. It's, as we said at the beginning of the program, people are afraid of things they don't know. But people also like to be afraid. They like to be frightened. They like to have things happen that they can't explain, so that they can shiver and shake and tell their friends all about it, give them good conversation. At the same time, they want things that will frighten them, but which they know or that they suspect will not actually harm them. And with things like ghosts and apparitions, spectral lights, etc., they can't be harmed by these. They know that a ghost can appear and can frighten the heck out of them, but it probably wouldn't actually physically harm them. So people like to get a charge that way. Of course, it's encouraged by all these ghost shows that you mentioned that are popping up all over the television, all these paranormal clubs and societies. There's just this fascination. Here is something where we can all be pioneers, we can all be explorers, if you like. There's not much that we can go out and do in the physical world, but here's something where there's still room for us to investigate, to try to find out, to try to discover things ourselves. So joining a paranormal club and going out with a group and visiting a haunted house, we get the thrill of it, we get the thrill of being frightened or the possibility of being frightened, and we get the enticement of perhaps we'll discover something that hasn't been discovered before. So I think this has a lot to do with it.
Well, you know, I guess it really caught my eye, got my attention, some years ago, some friends of ours that was a newspaper reporter knew that I had some engineering experience and background and said, well, could we have a place out here that's haunted? Could you come out here and wire it up for us? And I thought, well, I don't know. I guess I could. Well, anyways, I went out and we put in, I got to thinking about how exactly it was that I wanted to try to pick up sounds. And so I connected up a couple of microphones and I had these mics running into a cascaded preamp situation. So there was a lot of gain on these mics. They were just horrendous in picking up sounds. You could drop a grain of sand in front of them, and they could hear something. And, of course, people walking through this old mansion, which was, I'll just say where it was the Craigfont Mansion, and it was built by General James Winchester. He was a Revolutionary War hero. He and Andrew Jackson were good friends, and Marcus Winchester, which was Winchester's son, laid out the city of Memphis, actually the plan for the city of Memphis. So this is a beautiful, beautiful old mansion, state property here, Tennessee state property, and an alarm system in there at that time that was just second to none. I mean, you couldn't breathe in the place without tripping the alarm system. So we went in and wired up these mics, and then I got a hold of a book called... what was it called now? By Constantine, I believe the guy's name is Rodive, where he had come up with an electronic device to try to pick up voices and whatnot. And all basically yeah. Was a
yes,
was a,
yeah. He was one of the original pioneers of that sort of thing. Yes.
I'm trying to think what the name of that book was. Anyways, it was Breakthrough. The name of the book was Breakthrough. So I read through this thing, and there was a diagram in there as to how to build this thing. So I built it. You know, I'm a big kit builder. I used to build Heath kits when I was a kid.
Uh-huh.
So anyways, I built this thing up, and I connected up one channel to this device and the other channel to the microphone system, and away we went. And so this was kind of late in the evening by the time I got all the soldering done and the wires placed, because it all had to be hidden because it's a state museum, and they do tours during the day, so you can't have anybody getting on to the fact that what's under the bed is an electronic device. You know, so this was all put very, very neatly in order, and we locked the place up, turned on the alarm system, and walked over to the curator's the curator's headquarters or home where they lived. I'm losing my train of thought here. And that was about maybe 100 yards back behind the mansion, and we had underground cable running that had already been put in place by the phone company, but it was really shielded good, and there was a pair of wires, and I used a balanced line to get back out to their place, so we had low noise. Hooked it up to an amplifier, speaker system, and at that time a cassette recorder. And all this digital stuff had not come down the pike yet. And we're sitting there listening and drinking a cup of coffee, and all of a sudden there's footsteps just pronounced, and all of a sudden a door slams. And I just about come off of my chair. you know, because, I mean, I had just wired this stuff up, and I thought, what are these sounds? What is this, you know? So immediately, I'm somebody's down there, you know, the guy that was kind of in charge of, his name was Lowell, and he was actually a sheriff's deputy, so he was, you know, he had, I mean, he was a pretty, and a skeptic on top of that. He was a believing skeptic, one of the very, you know, a very strange combination, but
right.
It was kind of like he didn't want to believe it, he was forced to, he was uncomfortable believing it, but anyways, we went down to, I insisted I needed to get back in that place, and I wanted to see what was going on. And, of course, the alarm system had to be dismantled and or turned off, you know. And then I asked, I said, can you unplug this from the phone line? And I want to try tripping the alarm. And so he armed it and disconnected the phone line. And I did a few things. And every time, and I could not get into the place without or move around inside, because I stood perfectly still in a corner and had him fire up the alarm system. And I tried walking in there, I tried to crawl on the floor. They had sensors in the floor. You couldn't move in that place with that alarm system on. So how in the world did somebody or something leave footsteps and slam a door without setting off that alarm system? You know, and the doorway upstairs to the general's bedroom was open out onto the balcony, and it was closed when we had left. And then there were impressions in the bed. They would have impressions in the bed in the morning when they would come in, you know. So, and I'd been out there several times. We went out one time to re-solder a connector because they were getting a hum on the tapes. And while I was in there, we left the recorder running. And while we were inside the mansion, and I'm talking to Kim, who is Lowell's wife, and my son Matt was out on the front porch playing with a little car. Of course, it sounded like a freight train because of the sensitivity of those microphones. And I asked him, I said, how long has this been going on? And she started telling me of the story about the Satterfields and these different people that owned the place. And when we got back, I rewound the tape, and there was a voice on the tape. When I asked her, how long has this been going on, this voice goes, I've been here for years and years. And, I mean, just as crystal clear. I mean, you know, that was my introduction to what they now call EVP.
Right.
And that nearly drove me crazy because I'm a radio engineer, and there's no way that voice got, I mean, how in the world did this happen? You know, and I struggled with this for a long, long time. And it challenged a lot of my religious beliefs, too, on top of that. See, so I was kind of forced into a corner. Well, I've said enough about that. Tell me a little bit about this book, too, the Wiser Guide to Field, the Field Guide to Ghosts, and how did you come about writing this, and if what can folks find in this book? Because we've got a lot of folks out there now that are that can really use this thing.
Right. Well, Red Wheel Wiser is the publisher, and hence the name Wiser Field Guide. And they decided to, they publish a lot of books, and they decided to start this new series of field guides. They're going to do field guide to ghosts, field guide to vampires, field guide to UFOs, probably, things like this. But they wanted to start off with ghosts, so they asked me if I would write this first one for them. So I said, sure. And I thought, now, how am I going to present this? What sort of ghosts are there? So I started listing all the different types of ghosts and forms of ghosts. And ghosts, of course, are found universally. They're found around the world. Every country has ghosts, and most countries have their own particular names for these ghosts. And so I listed all of these, and then I thought, well, this is all very well, but it's a general mishmash, so we need to put it in some sort of order. So I then started sorting them out into the animal ghosts, and apparitions and materializations and monsters and poltergeists and things like that, and vampires, spectral lights. So I set them up like that. It was going to be a small book, since it was going to be a field guide. They only wanted like 30,000 words, something like that. So I didn't have a lot of room to get into details about these, but enough to cover all the different types of ghosts that I came across, and to give an idea of what they were and how they appeared. And I found a lot of duplication. A particular type of ghost would be found, say, in Europe, and would also be found in Australia, or would be found in South America or wherever. Sometimes with a different name, but basically the same sort of ghost. But I found it fascinating writing this, because there were, for instance, a lot of animal ghosts. a lot of animals who had died and who were seen afterwards. There was this young boy who was playing with his friends, and he was running through a cornfield, I think it was, and suddenly he came across this little brown and white puppy, and he recognized it as the puppy he'd had that had died the year before, and the puppy went scampering off through the corn, so he went chasing after it, and suddenly it disappeared, and he came upon the little sort of concrete gravestone that he and his mother had put there when they buried the puppy. Things like this I came across. One thing I came across, which I thought was quite unusual, was a ghost house. Now, I don't mean a haunted house, I mean a ghost house. It was a house that was sometimes there and sometimes wasn't. And it is located right in the middle of Chicago. So any listeners in the Chicago area can check it off. Apparently, it's off 143rd Street. There's a ghost house there that appears on the corner, and it always looks the same. It has wooden columns outside. It has a porch swing. Dim lights show from the inside, but sometimes it's seen on one corner of the street, and sometimes it's seen on the other corner of the street. So this is something I hadn't come across before. I was fairly familiar with ghosts. I lived for almost 5 years in New Hampshire, and I had an old house there which was built in 1820. And it was a beautiful old house, and at one point somebody had added a screened-in porch across the front of it, and it was fully screened in with a very squeaky screen door at the end of it out onto the driveway. And this house was haunted. We had at least three, four different ghosts there. My wife and I would be sitting in the living room, and we would hear footsteps walking across the room above, and my elder son's bedroom was above, but this was a time when nobody else was in the house, and the footsteps would walk across, and then one time we heard the footsteps walk across, and then start to come down the stairs, and we heard these footsteps coming down the stairs quite loudly, and I got up and went to the bottom of the stairs to look, and there was nobody there. One time, my wife's mother was staying with us, and she was sleeping in that bedroom. And she reported that in the middle of the night, she woke up for some reason, and there, standing at the foot of the bed, was a woman dressed all in blue who was just standing there, staring at her. And then the woman turned away and just disappeared, just evaporated. One time, I was in my office, and it had windows out onto the front of the house, onto the porch. And I heard the screen door squeak open, and so I looked up, and there was a man came onto the porch and walked across towards the front door. So I got up and went through to the front door to open it. He didn't ring the bell. There was no bell or anything. So I opened the door, and there was nobody there. The porch was fully screened in, as I say, but there was nobody on the porch. The squeaky screen door hadn't squeaked again. There's nobody in the driveway. It was a long driveway up to the road. There was nobody there. So we had a number of ghosts there. So I was fairly familiar with ghosts and comfortable with them, which I think is an important thing. I think if you are in fear and trembling, if you're really frightened of ghosts, then it can draw perhaps negative type of spirits to you. I think if you're comfortable, if you welcome them, if you speak to spirits, then you do well. You don't get anything which is antagonistic, and it can be an interesting experience. So anyway, I wrote this book, and it came out. It seems to have been very well received so far. There's some of the more traditional stories in there, like the Versailles ghosts, some of the historical ghosts, like Adams and people like that, some of the celebrity ghosts, John Wayne appearing on his old yacht and things like that. But I think there's also enough new material, enough interesting material that just about anybody should be able to enjoy the book. But I had fun writing it, but then I have fun writing all my books.
Well, let me ask you this question. Now, you talked a little bit about if you talk to ghosts or talk to spirits that you you know that you I guess it it shows a lack of fear, and therefore you don't get taken advantage of by the spirit world, so to speak. Okay, well, you know, it's an interesting thing, and I keep referring back to biblical things, but in the Bible it says try the spirits, which indicates that in order to try something, you have to communicate with it. You can't try something by standing across the room and staring at it. But let me ask you this question, because you went down this road. And this is a question that was actually forwarded to me by your publicist. And most of the questions that come in by the publicist, we go so far deeper that. But this is a good one. And this one says, "Can ghost hunting be dangerous? What do you think about that? You see all this stuff going on and folks wandering out into these places. Now, there is some danger, some physical danger, when you go into an old house." There's danger of falling through a rotten floor. You know, I mean,
exactly.
But
sorry, go ahead.
But I'm wondering about the other side of it. I mean, is it possible for something foul to follow you home? You know, and then you have a problem with all kinds of things happening over the next several months or whatever. I mean, how do you feel about all that?
I think there is a very slim possibility of something like that, and it is very, very slim. There's an old saying in the metaphysical world that like attracts like. If you're the sort of person who goes out to chipping up old ladies and kicking dogs and cats out of the way, then you're going to attract some pretty negative types of spirits to you. If you're the sort, such as you and I, Ted, who go out and hug trees and are full of love, then you're not going to attract anything negative. But it kind of swings around. A good example, let's come around to the subject of Ouija boards, which will tie in with this. Now, a lot of people are scared with this out of with Ouija boards. They think that they're dangerous, they're tools of the devil, that they should be banned, they should be burned, whatever. Yet Ouija boards are nothing but tools. They're like your EVF meter, your any tool. It's not dangerous in itself, it's how it's used. And Ouija boards are a focus for spirits. You sit at a Ouija board for the sole purpose of communicating with spirits, and so you attract them there. Now, if you are, as I say, a good type person, then you will only attract positive spirits. If you are a very negative sort of person, you'll attract negative spirits. But Ouija boards have really got a bad name because, well, for one thing, they're sold at places like Toys R Us. Now, a Ouija board is not a toy. It's a tool. But young kids, for instance, will go and buy a Ouija board to have fun with it. You don't buy a Ouija board to have fun with it. Although you can enjoy it, certainly. But it's a serious tool. A lot of kids will buy this, and somebody, of course, will push the planchette, will push the thing around so that it says what they wanted to say, pretending that it's a spirit coming through, and will scare the wits out of the other kids using the board. Sometimes it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Some young girl perhaps asks, well, when am I going to die? And the board spells out in 2 weeks, and in 2 weeks, time she's so nervous she steps off the curb without looking and she gets hit by a truck, something like that. But in itself, the Ouija board is a very good tool. It connects you with spirit. Now, how you deal with that spirit is another thing. Now, in the same way as going into a haunted house, you're connecting with spirit. And if going into a haunted house, there might be a number of spirits already there, coming to that particular place out of habit, if you like, or just this is the way the place where they always manifest because of their history or whatever. So you haven't got the control that you have with the Ouija board. So you might go to a haunted house and there'd be a very negative spirit. And you ask, could such a spirit follow you home? It's possible, yes. Because if the spirit, let's say, there's a spirit of someone who had died, and they weren't fully aware that they had died, and this often happens. This is why a lot of ghosts are around, because they're not aware of the fact that they've passed over. They think that the house still belongs to them, that they still live in the house. So if there's a figure like this, and it perhaps feels lonely, in effect, wants to find out what's happening, wants communication. And so when you go there and sort of prod it awake and start messing around, it sees you as contact with the physical world again. And so when you leave, it might leave with you to keep that contact. Again, if you are a very positive sort of person, then it won't stay with you very long if it's a negative sort of spirit. But this sort of thing is very, very rare. 99% of the time, I would say, you cannot be harmed by the spirits, by ghosts. The major trouble, the major danger comes, as you say, from walking on rotten floorboards, from being so frightened that you back up and fall downstairs, or from testing the electric in a house and electrocuting yourself, something like that. Something in this physical world can be the harm. But from the spirit world, no, it's very, very rare. So there's one, suddenly comes to mind, one type of spirit, labeled a spirit, is the poltergeist. Poltergeist literally means a noisy ghost. And really, this is not a ghost or a spirit per se. It's energy. A poltergeist, there's been a lot of poltergeist experience found over the years, and it's usually tied in with a house or place where there is a young child connected with the place, with the house, with the room. Quite often it's a young girl, but not always, but it's a child usually around the age of puberty. And it seems that as the child is reached that age, there are all sorts of things going on in their physical body, which affects their spiritual body as well. There's a lot of energy back and forth. And this can sometimes trigger what we term poltergeist activity, where the energy can cause things to move, can cause plates to fly through the air, can cause chairs to tip over, can cause doors to slam open, banging open and closed, can cause things like this. And sometimes in that sort of circumstance, if you've got things flying through the air, somebody might be struck by one of those things. But they weren't struck deliberately by a spirit. They were struck because this energy has thrown it. It's like standing somewhere near an explosion and shrapnel from the explosion hits you. So that's about the only sort of danger that I can really see, Ted, with anything like this.
Well, you know, I guess what comes to mind, and that is my sheriff's deputy friend who was in the Craigfont mansion in the basement sweeping the floor one day. And something hurled a broadaxe across the room at him. In other words, he really felt that this was, if it wasn't aimed to hit him, it was certainly aimed at him in the general area to frighten him. When I was in this place at night, it became just evil. I mean, it was weird. It was during the day the most peaceful, serene place, to the point where you wouldn't, I mean, it was almost too serene. But then at night, you know, it was like, you know, it was something like out of the worst horror show you've ever seen. I mean, you were just gripped with this, I don't know how many you call it, this heavy feeling, like there was 1,000 eyes staring at you at all times. It was pretty strange, you know. You know, so which brings up this question, because I mean, you're just the expert at this. I mean, I don't know of anyone that I could talk to today. If someone said to me, who would be the foremost authority on spirits and on Wicca and all these kind of things, candle ceremonies and all of this, you know, who is the foremost expert? I would have to say Raymond Buckland, because I don't know of anyone else that has. I mean, after reading a number of your books and everything, I realized the amount of research and intense interest that you have in this subject. You know, what about the dark side of all of this? I mean, you know, I made a study some years ago. I made a study of the Book of Enoch. I don't know if you've ever read Enoch. It's a pretty scary book, you know. And I guess I realize that even from a biblical standpoint, there's all these different spirits that are referred to there. And I don't really know what the hierarchy is. How much do we know about the spirit world? How much do we actually understand about it? And what about that dark side that we talk about? What about all of that?
I think that there is a dark side, yes. Now, how we label it, that's a different thing. There are, just as in this world, in the physical world, as we move through it, there's a lot of negativity. There are people who are downright horrible. There are people who cause wars. There are people who go around murdering people, serial killers and the like. And so in the spirit world, the spirits like that who have gone on, taken over those feelings. And where you get, as you say, a house where it seems to be full of antagonistic spirits, it is probably spirits who feel that this is their house and they don't want other people coming into it. Your friend was there, okay, if they could cause an axe to fly across the room close enough to him to scare him out of there, then that's what they want to do. I think it would have been unlikely that he would have actually been hit with the axe, but of course we don't want to run that experiment to see. But I think, yeah, that they wanted him out, and I think a lot of negative spirits are just trying to frighten. But I think in the past, of course, the church labeled any sort of negative spirit as a devil. The church, of course, believes in a major devil, a Satan, if you like, whatever term you want to give him. If we go back prior to Christianity, then there wasn't that belief in an all-powerful negative figure. Except just before Christianity in Persia, of course, with the light and the dark, the Zoroastra and Ahriman. But before that, generally, the gods and the spirits were thought of as much like human beings. They could be good, they could be bad, they could have their good moods, they could have their bad moods. But with the coming of Christianity, everything negative was labeled as of the devil, a part of the devil, a minion of the devil. And so there are a lot of negative spirits who, from the church's point of view, are doing the work of the devil, who are small devils, demons, whatever you want to call them. But I think they're just negative spirits of people who, as I say, were very negative on this earth, whether murderers or whatever, who have died, gone across, and their spirits are still there. I don't personally, and this is a personal feeling, I don't believe that anyone is all evil. I don't think there is a totally evil person. If you look at, okay, say Hitler, Hitler did terrible things, caused the death of thousands, millions of people, including a lot of gypsies, of course. But he was also very, very fond of children, very, very good with children, very loving with them. So there was an aspect of him, so he wasn't totally evil. Saddam Hussein, okay, he wasn't totally evil. He had great love for his family, for his daughters. He was very, very good with his daughters. So basically, I don't believe that anybody is totally evil. I think they can have tendencies, they can be negative to the point almost where certainly the church would label them as demonic or devilish or whatever. But I don't think that any spirit is totally that way. I think it's just a carryover of how they were in this life.
Well, let me ask you this question. What about non-human spirits?
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, okay, I believe there are non-human spirits. I think of divas, of nature spirits, for example. There are a tremendous number of these. I even believe that I've seen some nature spirits. I believe that anything has spirit within it. In fact, this has been proven. It's a very good book called The Secret Life of Plants. You may be familiar with it, Ted.
The Secret Life of what? I didn't hear that.
Secret Life of Plants.
Okay, all right.
Sorry, I said plants. The famous, excuse my English, coming through. The Secret Life of Plants, and it deals with experiments conducted with various plants, flowers, vegetables, various types, and treating them and getting electronically, with your various meters, getting reactions and finding that they can be frightened, they can be terrified, they can be pleasured, they can be happy. So we feel that there is definitely life as we know it within plants, within the vegetable kingdom. And I feel then that this indicates the presence of a spirit within that vegetable kingdom, that all vegetables have spirits, the same way that all animals do, not just the human animal, but birds, fish, whatever. I think if you think of going to the afterlife, what Christians would term heaven, if you think of going to heaven, what sort of a heaven would it be if there were no birds singing, if there were no rabbits scurrying through the grass or anything like that? So obviously these things must have a spirit to go there, to go on to the afterlife. And I think it's not restricted to life as we might immediately think of it, plant life, we might think of animal life. But what about trees, which is, of course, an extension of plant life? What about rocks, crystals? And I think there's energy there which could be labeled as spirits. It's a question of terms we use, but I believe that all rocks and the like, there's energy within them. So I think that the whole earth, in effect, then possesses spirits broken down into its different aspects.
You know, you're talking about the plants. Now, my aunt, or some folks would say aunt.
Yeah, right.
She was constantly talking to her plants, and she would sing to her plants and talk to her plants,
and I bet they grew beautifully.
They did. It was incredible. And other folks would say, well, how do you grow such beautiful? And it was regardless of what she grew, it did well. And
right.
And she said, well, I just water them, and when I water them, I talk to them, and I tell them how beautiful they are and how pretty they are and how I just love having them around and all this. And I mean, she did. I mean, I watched her do this. And these things would just grow, and I mean, they would flourish, and people would bring her plants that were half dead that you wouldn't think had a chance. And right. she would water them. And I don't think she used, like, plant food or nothing like that. You know, she would sometimes she would put, you know, like, she would take something from the kitchen. Like, she'd maybe take a small piece of hamburger meat and put it in the soil. And I thought, this is really crazy. But she would talk to these plants, and these old dead things, they would just come right back to life. And
more than that, Ted, if I can interrupt you just a moment, there have been experiments done where they've taken two plants exactly the same and put them in separate rooms, and to one of them they've said all these nice things and sung to them and spoken to them, and that plant has flourished, and with the other one they have gone in there and cursed it and said all sorts of nasty things to it and just treated it abominably, and that plant has withered.
That's amazing. Well, you know, I had some guests on here. Oh gosh, this has been maybe a couple of years ago, and they were talking about, and I never was able to research this to verify it, but they actually would like pray over and bless water.
Yes.
And when they would do this, the water when you froze the water, the crystals from the blessed water was different than the water that if they spoke evil to the water and all this, you know, the resulting energy was as the ice crystals formed completely different between the two sectors of water. And I thought about that, and I thought, you think about water as being an inanimate object, but really it's not. You know, I mean, when you get right down to right down to it, you know. This is all very fascinating stuff. And of course, now, you know, it's strange with talking to you, because I could shift gears and go to a completely different subject, and you'd have just a wealth of information in that area as well. So, but now these two books, let's get back to the Gypsy book, because I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that book and what you've put in the book, what kind of things folks can find in there, because the subject of gypsy magic is, it's just so mysterious and unusual. It's like something that if you had the book in your hand, you could literally get lost in it. It's one of those things that once you start reading it, you really can't put it down. And I think that the human curiosity just goes off the scale when it comes to this kind of thing. So talk a little bit about that. And what exactly, how, you know, what is gypsy magic, and what... To what end was gypsy magic, worked and performed by gypsies, and is it, does it still go on today?
Well, it certainly does still go on today. But gypsies, I mean, the gypsies themselves wouldn't look upon this as magic. This is just everyday living, basically. Having had to survive so many things for so many centuries in order to continue living, they've learned a tremendous amount, and they've stored it, they've passed it on. Gypsies have kept very much to themselves. They marry between tribes. A tribe is basically just an extended family. And so they keep within themselves. And so these things have been passed on from father to son, from mother to daughter, passed on and on. And they're just things which they've gathered over the years as they've traveled around. And there's a tremendous amount on healing. They've done a lot of healing. And in this book, there's a segment on gypsy healing, hands-on healing, dealing with things like head and neck ailments, chest and stomach ailments, all sorts of things. Anything that ails you, that ails the ordinary person has at some time caused a gypsy to ail. So they've searched around to find remedies for it. And what I've done is collected a lot of these gypsy remedies and put them into book form. The what might be termed more magic rather than healing is causing things to happen. What is magic? Magic is basically making something happen that you want to happen. Of course, old Aleister Crowley had a wonderful definition of that, and that was that magic is the art of causing change to occur in conformity with will, which is basically making something happen that you want to happen. And the gypsies have several ways of working magic. They mainly do what we would call sympathetic magic, taking something to represent something else. As with candle burning magic, you take candles to represent people or things. If you're trying to get money, you need money, then you can take a green candle to represent money, and you take another candle to represent yourself and do a very simple ritual where basically you gradually move that green candle across to the white candle, and that is sympathetically drawing money to yourself. Well, gypsies work that sort of way by taking objects to represent themselves or to represent what they want to happen and using them.
You're listening to Radio Disclosure. Our guest today is Raymond Buckland, and we'll be right back right after this. As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Transworld Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building, and they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it, and it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. Transworldantennas.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEEN BEAN. theunseenbean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of the Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Are you needing a place to put up a website? Have you looked around? You want to do something that's easy, that's simple, and very, very inexpensive, but yet looks professional? Are you having troubles with your computer? Do you need some tech support help? Are you tired of being connected to India every time you pick up the telephone to get some help on a machine or on a website? The people to call is tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. T-U-X, like tuxedo, dash support, the word support.com. These are the people to call. They can get you going. It won't cost you an arm and a leg. You can afford to work with these folks. They're professionals. They answer in plain English, and they can help you do things from a very, very basic, simple standpoint. If you have something that you want to do that's a complex project, well, they can handle that as well. But if you're like I am, when you're trying to put something up on the web or you need help with a computer, you really want somebody that speaks English. And you want it to be simple, and you don't want to have to pay an arm and a leg for it. And you want to deal with some good folks. Go to their website, tux-support.com. That's tux-support.com. As a listener to Radio Disclosure, we want to know that you're there. Why don't you just go to our website at radiodisclosure.com. That's radiodisclosure.com. Go to the very bottom of the right-hand corner where it says Contact Us. Click on that and send us a note. Let us know you're listening. And if you do, place in your note the words, I want to win, because we have some items of interest that you may want to receive. Each month we have a drawing and we give away a number of things, depending on how big the closet is, to a number of listeners that write us at Radio Disclosure. So give us your comments. Tell us what you think about the show. Make some guest suggestions. Tell us about things you may not like. And be sure and put in there, I want to win. Mention the items of interest. Once again, the website is radiodisclosure.com. Radiodisclosure.com. And we do QSL. So let us know you're listening. We would really appreciate it. We'd like to know where you're at, what you're listening on, and all that kind of stuff. Radiodisclosure.com. You're listening to Radio Disclosure. Raymond Buckland has authored two new books, The Buckland's Book of Gypsy Magic and The Wiser Field Guide to Ghosts. He talks about both of them as we return now to our guest, Raymond Buckland, on Radio Disclosure.
There are two main forms of magic, I guess. That which is which they can plan ahead for, and that which has to be done immediately. For instance, if a young boy slips from a vado and breaks his leg, then obviously there's something got to be done immediately. Some healing magic has to be done immediately. So they look around and see what is there. They might find a cast-off horseshoe. They might find some acorns that have fallen from a tree. They might find a blue feather from a blue jay or something like that. But they gather what they can find immediately and then put that to use magically. They think, okay, the acorns represent strength. They come from the oak tree. So here's something which we can put in a cloth, a diplo, which is the gypsy scarf, wrap it in a diplo, and wrap it around the boy's leg, and it will give strength to the leg. The same sort of thing with the cast-off horseshoe. This represents strength. It also represents the horse moving forward, so it's an advancement. So this, perhaps, they'll somehow tie in, perhaps they'll tie it to the foot of the boy, to the boy's foot. The feathers, the blue jay feather, okay, it comes from a bird which flies through the air, which has full freedom of its limbs, of its wings. So this is what the boy needs again. So they'll work these objects into some sort of magic that they can perform to help a cure, to help mend that broken leg. Now, the other sort of magic is where they can plan ahead. let's suppose that a young gypsy couple are going to get married and they want to have children. And so the young man who's going to be the groom knows that the wife-to-be wants to have children, so he's planned ahead. He does some magic looking ahead. He will search perhaps for several days until he finds perhaps a bird's nest in the bush, perhaps one with eggs in it already. So he'll take that. He'll search around again for acorns. Acorns feature a lot in gypsy magic because they do represent the strength of the oak tree, the power and strength. So acorns might be brought into it. He might take the branch of a tree and carve a name into it. Perhaps if they're going to have children, have a child, they've already thought of a name that they're going to have for the child. So that name will be carved into this piece of wood, and it will be perhaps buried at the foot of an oak tree. So this is the form of magic where they can plan ahead, where they can seek out the things that they're going to need to do their magic. So a lot of the magic, as I say, is of the sympathetic variety. They have spells, they have divination, they do a lot of divination, which is not magic per se. It is divination. It is looking into the future, seeing what's coming, and obviously gypsies need to know what's coming. So interestingly enough, the gypsies are not too bothered about the future. They really live for the day. And in Romanus, which is the English Romany language, there is no word for tomorrow. They only have a word for today or for yesterday, because yesterday is a day that's already gone by. But they have no word for tomorrow because they're living for today. They're living for what is going on at the moment. There's magical tools that they might use in the form of talismans. They're great believers in protective talismans. They do believe in negative spirits possibly being around. Because they've traveled so much, they don't know what the territory is that they're going to go into. They don't know what might be there. A good example of protective talismans are found on their horses, what are called horse brasses. These are brass ornaments. It looks like ornaments that hang from the harness of horses. But they're very specific ornaments. They're made to protect the horse, to give him strength, to keep evil, to keep illness at bay. The gypsies will make talismans for themselves that they will wear. There are all sorts of charms that they do. So there's a wide variety of gypsy magic. And in this book, I detail them. I detail the various types, give examples of them. And dotted throughout the book are the various gypsy beliefs, the old red sky at night, gypsy's delight sort of thing. If there are red clouds in the west at sunset, it will be fine the following day. If they have a tint of purple, it will be very fine, things like that. If a cock crows when you go to bed, then you'll get up with a very wet head. In other words, it will be raining in the morning. So all these things I've put together, the traveler's stories, gypsy's stories, spells, the healings, all together in this book. I am, incidentally, dead. I am a half-blood gypsy myself. My father was a full-blood. My grandfather was what would be called a gypsy king. The gypsy word is Kralis. He was a Romany Kralis, which just means that he was the patriarch of the tribe. He was the head of the extended family. So there are many, many gypsy kings. Every tribe has its Kralis, has its head. My grandfather was one. My father was full-blood gypsy, as was my uncle. My mother was not. She was non-gypsy. So I'm a half-blood, what's known as a posh rat. Posh rat. Posh is the gypsy word for half. Ratty, R-A-T-T-I, is the word for blood. So posh ratty, shortened to posh rat, is a half-blood. So that's me.
Let me just ask you a question, though. Do you carry a talisman on you?
As a matter of fact, yes. I wear a Queen Victoria gold sovereign around my neck. And this was a pretty common sort of talisman for a lot of gypsies. they always carried their money with them, of course. They didn't go to banks. They didn't believe in banks. This is why you'll see a lot of gypsy costumes with gold coins decorating them. The coins are there partly for decoration, but partly as a way of carrying their money around with them. And if a gypsy has a sovereign, for example, hanging around his neck, then he knows that he'll never be entirely penniless. If the worst comes to the worst, he's always got something he can turn to put food on the table. A gypsy, incidentally, male gypsy always wears an earring. As a child, a boy child is given two gold earrings, one in each ear. And when he grows up, when he finds the one woman of his life, he will give her the right earring. So you can always tell whether a gypsy male is married or single by whether it has one or two earrings.
That's fascinating. This is very, very captivating. Let me ask you a question, though. With this book, one of the notes that I had written when I had gone through the book and I was looking at things, there were things in there, like, for example, referring to hexes. There's some reference to hexes. What do you believe about hexes? Do you think hexes actually work? I mean, I'm asking this honestly, not antagonistically. I mean, tell us a little bit about hexes. That's the first thing folks think of. They think, oh, that gypsy's going to put a hex on me here. So, you know, but what do you think about all that? I mean, it's like Marie Laveau and voodoo down in, right.
Yeah, and with voodoo, yes, I certainly believe strongly in that. As for a gypsy putting a hex on you, it's most unlikely that they'd have no reason to, unless you've done something really, really bad for them. But, I think there can be certainly the effect of a hex, whatever you want to call it, whether you want to call it a hex, a curse, or whatever. I think, yes, words have tremendous power. And as we spoke earlier, belief and feelings, I believe very strongly that we create our own reality. And so I think we can create a reality that can affect somebody else. Now, by my Wiccan beliefs, I don't believe that you should ever try to affect somebody else negatively. But gypsies, of course, are not Wiccans, and they have their own beliefs, their own feelings. And a lot of them believe very strongly in evil spirits. They believe in vampires. They believe in ghosts. They believe in a lot of this stuff. Simply from having traveled the road for so many hundreds of years, this is built up. You mentioned voodoo. I believe very much that a voodoo curse can have effect. And I initially thought that it was mainly psychological. I thought that if the voodoo said that he had put a curse on you, or somehow let you know that a curse had been put on you, then it would have psychological effect, even if you outwardly laughed it off and said no such thing could happen. There would be that little niggling doubt, and it could have some sort of effect that could lead to some sort of deterioration or something detrimental. But there have been cases, well-documented cases, of people who have been cursed with a voodoo curse, and where they've known absolutely nothing about it having been placed, and yet it has had effect. Now, I don't pretend to understand how that can happen, but I believe that it does. In fact, I've seen that it does. I was very interested in voodoo for many years. In fact, I traveled to Haiti back in the early 70s and spent some time there and saw a tremendous amount happening there. And I spent a lot of time in New Orleans in the more, should we say, the more commercial aspect of voodoo there. But yeah, I believe, Ted, I believe that there are curses, there are hexes, and that they can have effect, yes.
Not to delve any further into this, further than we should go, but what about vampires? I mean, there's a fascination we have, of course, with ghosts and things, but my goodness, I mean, I go back to my childhood and Bela Lugosi and all the films and whatnot, and you know, the curse of the vampire and all this. Do you believe there is any in the any possibility in the real existence of vampires?
No, I don't. I can see, I think, how it might have come about in the belief in the an evil person dying and then fear that, wow, perhaps they'll come back and attack me. And that growing into the idea of someone not dying properly and coming back and not just attacking, but actually drinking your blood. And I could see how it could build up. Though, interestingly, there's talk, stories of vampires around the world, just about. So many countries have them. And you can't help thinking, well, gee, where there's smoke, perhaps there must be some fire somewhere. But personally, I don't believe it, at least in the way it's been presented so often, certainly from Bram Stoker and onwards. I don't believe that somebody would die, would be buried, would come out of the coffin and would come back and drink blood and would thus live on for years and years and years. No. I believe in psychological vampires, and I think there are a lot of those around, people who think of themselves as vampires and will drink somebody else's blood, believing that they are vampires and perhaps even believing that they need to do this to continue living. But these people are usually younger people, or not all of them younger, actually, but they certainly have no history of centuries of life or no history of having been certified as dead and been buried and come back from the grave to do this. So the only vampires I really believe in are the psychological ones. I don't think that the true vampire of the Bram Stoker, Bela Lugosi variety, I don't believe in that, no.
Well, I was going to say, because I feel I have met some vampires, and why I say that is there are certain people that can just literally suck the life out of you. Just their very presence.
Psychic vampires, yeah, I can certainly believe in psychic vampires, yes.
And some of those folks are family members, and I mean, I've watched it. It seems like they prey on the living even after they're dead. I mean, they pretty well near finish you off during their lifetime, and then when they're gone, their memory continues to work on you. And I wondered.
Psychic vampire is usually unconscious. I mean, there are many people like that who absolutely drain your energy, drain everything, but they don't know they're doing it. It's not something they're setting out to do. It's just the way they are.
I noticed something here. I went up to your website, and folks, it's raybuckland.com. Just simply raybuckland.com. We'll mention this throughout the show here, but I noticed that you had co-authored a book with a fellow the last name of Carrington. How do you say his first name?
Harrowood.
I knew if I said it, I was going to slaughter it. I don't know if the gentleman is still around, but I had run across a book written by him some years ago on fasting. I have yet to see that book anywhere else, and I was wondering, do you know anything about that, or do you and here we are, we're going down another road here, do you have any particular beliefs in regards to fasting?
I believe in certain circumstances it can be very beneficial, but I think it can easily get out of hand. I think it's very easy to get detrimental results from over fasting. I think occasional fasting of like 24 hours at the most, perhaps, can be beneficial because it can help sort of flush all the negative energy, well, not just the energy, that any negative food, drink, whatever, out of your system. So it can help you get over things like that. But I think it can be carried to extremes where it becomes detrimental to you.
Well, I had read this book, and he was a real advocate of it in the book. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that you had co-authored with him, and I've kind of wondered about that fellow. I wondered whatever happened to him, and I often wondered. I guess the book is out of print. You probably can't get it anywhere, but
Yeah, well, you might be able to find on the web, but I didn't really co-author with him. I tell you what happened. He was dead by the time I wrote the book. I came across a book of his which was on psychic development, and I read it, and I found it very fascinating and very, very good. He had a lot of good stuff there. But it had been out of print for some years, and I thought, gee, this is a shame. This should be reprinted. But I thought that also it needed to be updated. There was a lot of stuff which has developed since, which has been discovered since, with things which are being done since then. So I took his book as the basis, and I went through, basically rewrote it, updated it, had bibliography, added details about more recent books on the different subjects. And then I offered it to a publisher, but I said, now, since his original book was in the public domain, then I can really just go ahead and use it myself with no acknowledgement. But I said that I felt, since it was based on so much of his material, that he needed to be acknowledged. So we presented it as though written by the two of us.
And I wanted to draw attention here to, what I had done is I was going on up on your website, because I know you've authored so many books, and I've got a number of them. I mean, I've read them over the years, and I was always fascinated because your approach was always very, very objective, and unlike a lot of books that find themselves into what people would say the occult realm, which turn out to be either, you know, extreme or just based on nonsense. You know, they've just written a book. But yeah. I'm going to go down a few of these titles because I want folks to I want them to get the picture here. I'm going down. It says A Pocket Guide to the Supernatural, and that was through Ace Books, I guess, or Tandem Books.
That was my very first book in 1969. Yes.
Practical Candle Burning Rituals, Witchcraft, Ancient and Modern, Witchcraft from the Inside, and you spoke about that earlier. Now this one I don't understand. How do you say this? M-U, is it Mu or
Mu?
Mu.
Mu.
Mu, yes. Revealed. Now, what in the world is that?
Well, back in the 1930s, a guy named Churchward, Colonel Churchward, he labeled himself, he wrote a book called The Lost Continent of Mu. And it dealt with a continent that was supposed to have existed in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Now, most people know of Atlantis that was supposed to have existed in the Atlantic Ocean. Well, this was in the Pacific. And it was Mu, sometimes called Lemuria, Muror, different names for it. Anyway, James Churchward wrote this book. And reading it, I thought that he had written it with his tongue firmly in his cheek because there was so much nonsense in it. But it apparently it sold like crazy when it first came out in the 30s. You know, the first edition in 1930, second edition 31, third edition 32, fourth edition 33, and so on. And it sold so well that he obviously thought, well, I've hit a gold mine, yes, so I'll follow up. So he then did another book called The Sacred Symbols of Mu, then another one. He did about four or five books on Mu. Well, in the 1970s, I think it was, a paperback library, a publisher in New York, decided to reprint these, and it got the same sort of reaction back in the 70s. The first edition of Lost Continent of Mu came out, published in April, second printing in May, third printing in June, July, August, so on and so forth. They just sold like hotcakes. So reading them, as I say, I thought that they were written with his tongue in his cheek, and there were so many errors and so many contradictions in them. I thought, this is ridiculous. So I thought, as a challenge now, I wonder if I could out Churchward. I wonder if I could do better than this. And his books were based on the discovery, so he claimed, of some stone tablets in Tibet and some clay tablets in the Valley of Mexico. And these tablets had symbols on them, And he interpreted these symbols, and by interpreting the symbols, he got this whole story of the lost continental moon. So I thought, well, in order to outdo him, I need something much more positive than just interpreting symbols. So I thought, supposing that we found some scrolls with the actual story written out. So I concocted this thing. I'll try to keep this short because this is a long story. But I decided to write a book where these scrolls have been discovered in a sarcophagus buried just a little bit deeper than he had dug in the Valley of Mexico. I found, incidentally, the original report of the diggings there by Niven, who did the original diggings, and there was no report of any clay tablets having been found there. But anyway, I decided that there was a sarcophagus buried there and these scrolls were in it. And so I came up with this book, giving all the details of Mu, which meant that I had to come up with details of the religion, the monetary system, measurements, just about every aspect of life on this lost continent. And I did it just thoroughly enjoying myself, just having a great time, and I didn't care if the thing ever got published or not. I just had so much fun writing it. And I called it Mu Revealed. And I decided, okay, we'll give some clues to this. So instead of saying that it was by myself, I love anagrams. I love mixing up letters of words and making other words. So I decided it would be written by Tony Earle, E-A-R-L-L. And Tony Earle, if you rearrange the letters, it says, not really. So it's Mu Revealed, not really. And throughout the book, I put all sorts of clues, anagrams and different things showing that the whole thing was a put-on. Anyway, I did this, and just for fun, I sent it off to Paperback Library to see if they'd be interested in publishing it. And almost immediately, I got back a contract for it.
Wow.
And I thought, well, this is all well and good, but I've got to be honest. I always try to be honest. So I wrote back to them, and I said, well, the contract you offer is certainly satisfactory. The advance you offer is satisfactory. However, I think there's something you should know. So I told them what I thought of Church World's books, why I thought it. And almost immediately, they sent back the contract and the advance. And all they had done was added a clause at the end of the contract saying that I would not reveal my sources to anyone. So it went on, went into a couple of editions. It was a lot of fun. I really had a lot of fun with that book. MGM wanted to make a movie based on it, but I made the mistake of being honest with them as well, and they didn't go ahead with it, and various other things came up. But anyway, that was Mu Revealed.
That's an amazing story, and I had no idea what I asked the question, because I, you know, it seems like I had seen this book somewhere, and I wondered about it, but I had never read it, never picked it up. But I want to move down this list a little bit here, because I want folks to be familiar with your writings, because I'm sure some of these folks have come across books that you've written. There's Amazing Secrets of the Psychic World, and that's the one that you...
With Herbert Carrington, right. Yeah.
Let's see here. The Tree Complete Book of Saxon Witchcraft. Have I got that right? Yeah. The Tree Complete Book of Saxon Witchcraft. Here is The Occult, House of Collectibles, Anatomy of the Occult, Magic of Chant-O-Matics. I'd ask, but I'm almost afraid to.
It's another story, yeah.
Practical Color Magic. Now, I'll tell you, folks have this whole thing with color has become quite the deal. And and folks that practice this stuff, what is it called, feng shui or something, and colors, yeah, play such a big deal in this. You know, there really is.
Definitely, yes.
Color Magic, Unleash Your Inner Powers. Buckland's Complete Book of Witchcraft. That goes back to what, 86, it says here. So
86, then, right, yeah. Right.
And then another one here, the second edition of Buckland's Complete Book of Witchcraft. Now, I believe I've seen those. I don't think I ever had those, but I have. Secrets of Egyptian...
The witchcraft one, that's one which has sold over 500,000 copies. Next year, they're bringing out the special 25th anniversary edition of it.
Wow, wow. Secrets of Gypsy Fortune Telling. Buckland Gypsy Fortune Telling Deck. Now, is that, I mean, that's a book.
No, it is just that. It's a fortune-telling deck. It's a deck of cards, which is used for fortune-telling. Similar to the tarot, but not exactly the same as the tarot, but it's a deck for a gypsy-based deck for telling fortunes.
Okay, there's also, it says here you got a layout sheet, too. Gypsy fortune-telling layout sheet. Secrets of Gypsy Love Magic. But there's a lot of folks that would like to get their hands on that book. Secrets of Gypsy Love Magic, Secrets of Gypsy Dream Reading.
You're listening to Radio Disclosure. Our guest today is Raymond Buckland, and we'll be right back right after this.
As a shortwave radio listener, you know there's no such thing as a good indoor antenna. If you're looking for an antenna that allows you to pull in those distant signals and also gets rid of the atmospheric noise, you need a good outdoor antenna. But in a lot of cases, folks can't have an outdoor antenna. Now you can. Trans World Antennas is the name of the company. The website is transworldantennas.com. Go to their site and check out the TW2010 or the 4040 or the 8080 for that matter. These are all antennas that will increase the sensitivity of your shortwave radio. It gets the antenna that receives outside of the indoor environment, away from electrical noise, the pops and cracks and things that go on inside a building, and they hide. The TW2010 just literally disappears wherever you put it. Folks don't see it. And it's a good antenna for your receiver. It's a good match for any shortwave radio. If you're having difficulty pulling in those distant signals, or if you're looking for a portable antenna that you can take with you wherever you go, you want it to be low profile, you want it to be stealth, where you can set it up and nobody really knows it's an antenna, this is the antenna for you. Go to the website, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. And get a TW2010, a 4040, or an 8080, whichever model best suits your receiving needs. You'll be glad you did. TransWorldAntennas.com.
Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com.
As a listener to Radio Disclosure, we want to know that you're there. Why don't you just go to our website at radiodisclosure.com. That's radiodisclosure.com. Go to the very bottom of the right-hand corner where it says Contact Us. Click on that and send us a note. Let us know you're listening. And if you do, place in your note the words, I want to win, because we have some items of interest that you may want to receive. Each month we have a drawing and we give away a number of things, depending on how big the closet is, to a number of listeners that write us at Radio Disclosure. So give us your comments. Tell us what you think about the show. Make some guest suggestions. Tell us about things you may not like. And be sure and put in there, I want to win. Mention the items of interest. Once again, the website is radiodisclosure.com. radiodisclosure.com, and we do QSL. So let us know you're listening. We would really appreciate it. We'd like to know where you're at, what you're listening on, and all that kind of stuff. radiodisclosure.com. You're listening to Radio Disclosure. Raymond Buckland has authored two new books, The Buckland's Book of Gypsy Magic and The Wiser Field Guide to Ghosts. He talks about both of them as we return now to our guest, Raymond Buckland, on Radio Disclosure. You know, and that's something, too. Gypsies are traditionally
given credit to be able to interpret dreams for people, and people would seek out a gypsy and say, I had this dream, you know. I mean, and I guess there's 50 books. I don't know that there's any point in going on and on, but I mean, I guess the thing is that you've written all these books, and that there's just a wealth of information here, including some screenplays.
Yeah.
So now the new book, the new one out now, the Buckland's Book of Gypsy Magic has got to be a real fascinating thing to read, and I highly recommend it, as well as The Guide to Ghosts. And these are available. I mean, you can find these just about anywhere. I mean, can you not at this point?
Any good bookstore and on Amazon.com on the internet, for example.
I was going to say Amazon, but I had a brain thing, and I couldn't come up with Amazon for some reason. And also, can these be ordered from your website at all? Can folks?
No, I'm so busy writing, I don't have time for selling. But they can be ordered from the publisher's website, wiserbooks.com. From them, from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, from any bookstore. And any bookstore that doesn't have them can order them for you if you want them.
One thing I did want to ask you about, and that is that you obviously are quite the expert on the gypsy cards and fortune telling. Tell us a little bit about that. How do you feel about that? Do you feel that there's any deal of? Do you feel there's any accuracy in this? I mean, is this something that
absolutely?
Folks,
if somebody knows what they're doing, then the tarot, for example, is very very accurate, or can be very very accurate. I think my personal feeling deep down inside is that basically we're just using these cards for a focal point. I think that reading the cards, the tarot, you're picking up energies from the person you're reading. You're picking up energies from everywhere, from the spirit world, from everywhere. But these cards are focal points. They trigger things. For example, if you turn over, well, a well-known one is the Hanged Man, where there's a man generally seen hanging by one foot. And so he's suspended. So this sort of triggers the idea of suspense. And when you're reading the tarot, it's not just the quest of interpreting the card and what is on the card, but also the position of the card. The different layouts, and depending which one you use, different positions of the cards mean different things. One, for instance, can deal with your hopes and fears. Another one can deal with the immediate future. Another one with the past, and so on and so forth. So looking at these cards in these particular positions, you can get a tremendous sense of what is going on with the person for whom you're reading just by that little trigger which clicks. A good example which I often give when in my workshops, there's one card in the Rider-Waite deck. There's so many, there are over 2,000 different tarot decks available these days. But most of them are still based on the old Rider-Waite deck. This was Arthur Edward Waite, who designed it, and it was originally published by Ryder, and Tamla Coleman Smith did the artwork. But the symbolism on that deck is picked up, and that deck is still used a lot. And one of the cards in that deck is labeled Death, the Death card. And it shows a skeletal figure in a suit of armor astride a horse, and he's holding a banner with a rose on it. And he's sort of addressing a bishop-like figure standing in front of him, and behind the bishop figure there are these open graves with figures looking out, and in the background there are two towers with a sun between them, and there's trees in the background, and a lake with a boat on it. And this one card, you can take that card and turn it over, and it doesn't just have one meaning, because we are all individuals. So if I'm reading the cards for, say, half a dozen different people, and that card just happens to come up in the same position in the layout, it's still not going to have the same meaning for all six people because that's six individuals. And what happens is that as I turn over the card, I have them face down initially, and as I turn it over when I come to it, it's what strikes me most forcibly as I turn it over. It might be the death figure. Usually this doesn't mean death, it just means the end of something. And of course, when you've got endings, you've got new beginnings and so on. But let's not get into reading the whole thing. But flipping it over, I might see that death figure. Or as I turn it over, the thing that hits me, first of all, is the sun between those two towers. And I might think, now, is that a rising sun or is that a setting sun? Or as I flip it over, it might be the little boats in the background, and that lake in the background, that might be what I see as I turn it over first. And so that's what relates to the person for whom I'm reading. So just that one card can have 100 different meanings depending on how I feel, what I get from it as I turn it over. And I find reading tarot, and I've read tarot for 50 years or so, I guess, I find reading tarot can be extremely accurate, yes.
I've always wondered about that, and I wanted to talk to an expert. But you feel that it's not necessarily just the cards; it's the energy that you feel doing.
Right. I think you could do a good reading with somebody like that. I know you can, without the cards, without anything. One thing that the cards do, as I say, as a focal point for the person for whom you're reading. So if I'm reading for a young lady and I lay out the cards, her eyes, of course, are fixed on the cards. She's listening to what I'm saying, but her eyes are focused on the cards. And that helps draw out from her certain energies, sort of gets the energy flowing. I don't have to look at the cards necessarily. I could sit there and just get stuff from her and tell her about herself. I could contact spirits. I could do whatever to make contact, to find out about her, to be able to tell her about herself. But by laying out those cards, it keeps her mind focused, it keeps draws her into it, so it becomes a two-party thing, a give and take. And it also gives me a trigger if I'm reading 20 people in a row, then I need something to keep me going. So it can work that way, but they're not absolutely necessary.
Do you find reading cards like that? Do you find that is it a draining experience? Do you feel tired when you get done with that, or is it exhilarating?
No, I don't. I don't often read cards these days. I used to years back, but these days I very, very seldom do. But a couple of years back, I went out to Camp Chesterfield, the big spiritualist community in Indiana. They were having a big psychic weekend, and I thought it might be fun to just go and read cards there. So I went out and I read for people for 2 days in a row, just one after the other. And the end of each day, I didn't feel drained at all. A little worn from sitting on the chair all that time, but not mentally drained. I don't know that there was any exhilaration, actually, but certainly no negative drainage.
Well, I was just curious, do you feel this is something that someone can learn, or is this something that is that you have an innate gift, I guess I want to say, from birth, that you can do this or you can't do this? How does that work in?
I think we all have these innate gifts in the psychic realm. When it comes to something like tarot, it's certainly something you can learn. And some people, as with teaching somebody the violin, you know, some pick it up much more easily than others, but all, if they stick at it long enough, can learn to play something on the violin. The same way with tarot, we can all learn tarot and can read, can give some sort of a reading, but some adapt to it much more easily, are able to pick up the finer points and the finer psychic or mental or whatever points. And give far greater in-depth, meaningful readings than other people. But yeah, it's something that can be learned.
Raymond Buckland, I really have enjoyed this. This has been quite a radio show. And I want to remind folks that if your fancy has been tickled here, if your curiosity has been piqued, there are two books you can go and get from Amazon or your local bookstore, and that's Buckland's Book of Gypsy Magic and also The Wiser Field Guide to Ghosts. And it's both of these books, you'll get lost in them. You'll just get lost in them like every other book that Raymond Buckland has authored. You pick them up, you won't put them down until you're done reading the things. But I really appreciate you coming on board today and joining us. This has been an incredible radio show, and you've kept me on the edge of my seat through the entire thing.
Well, thank you, Ted. It's very nice of you to say so, and I appreciate you having me here.
That's all the time we have today for Radio Disclosure. Be on the lookout for the books by Raymond Buckland that are just out, The Wiser Field Guide to Ghosts and Buckland's Book of Gypsy Magic. Special thanks to our guest, Raymond Buckland. Stay tuned next week, same time, same station for Radio Disclosure.